This is CliffCentral.com.
How's that for a bit of old school, huh? You like it? Oh, yes. Very nice. All right. So we got a lot to get through this morning. It's just after 7 o'clock.
7 o'clock.
7 o'clock.
Wake
Beautiful.
Up at 7 o'clock.
Yeah. It's great.
What is this place?
I know. It's a lunatic asylum. Especially first thing on a Monday.
I always just think in the odd instance that someone 20 years down the line would stumble on this podcast and listen to this exact moment, they'd think, 7 o'clock.
7 o'clock, yeah, sure. All right, loads of things, though, that I said we want to touch on this morning, and Leanne has obviously found some pretty bizarre stories that she feels she needs to share with us, especially in line of pets. We do this Christmas carols thing at my parents every year, and we try to raise money for the SPCA or the Salvation Army or whoever it is. And this year it was the SPCA's turn. And, you know, a lot of these animal charities really don't get a lot of funding from anywhere. And you have to donate what you can. And they rely heavily on private funding to be able to do that. So
yeah.
It was nice to also put some money together for them. But there are very, very bizarre people in the world who spend an inordinate amount of money on their pets.
Yeah.
And stupid stuff that they do for their pets.
Well, you say that, but people have like 5 kids.
That's true. Do you have any cat furniture in your house?
No, because let's be honest, there's a meme for a reason. Cats prefer boxes.
They do like a box.
Whatever's inside it, they're not interested in.
Like I get quite a few boxes from things that get delivered to me. So I think that the cats have like a 2-day grace in the box. And then the boxes keep changing and they have fun.
Oh, they love it. Mine sleeps in a box on my desk when I work. It helps keep it off of my laptop.
On Friday, I was obviously, you know, I was hugely hungover. So I got home and I got a delivery. Small box. It was these glasses you wear before you sleep. I'll tell you about that once I start using them more. Tiny box, okay? And it was swelteringly hot on Friday. Like, Meowsers and I literally passed out for an hour between 4 and 5. I wake up to our other cat, squeezed into this box. He was so happy. Into this, he was overflowing, but he was in a box and he was just so happy.
Yeah, our cats love boxes. But looking at strange things for dogs and what owners have done for them, this might have started off as strange, but it's become a proper line of protective clothing.
What do you mean?
So there's this little dog named Beanie.
Yes.
She's a Chihuahua. Yeah,
Chihuahua.
Better pronounced Chihuahua, yes.
Chihuahua.
And she has this beautiful protective gear.
Uh-huh.
It's a spiky vest, which has gone very viral. I hate to use the word.
Very viral.
On the internet. It's ricocheting around the internet.
Okay.
It's like a wild neon dog armor.
So why would she be wearing this?
She is coyote proof now that she's wearing this.
Oh, you mean she won't be eaten by a coyote because it won't be able to bite her because of this thing?
She lives in Arizona. And just trying to go for a walk is a huge threat. So this little Chihuahua is 8 years old. They live in a very remote area outside Sedona, Arizona,
mm-hmm.
in the Sonoran Desert,
mm-hmm.
with huge challenges, practical challenges to her daily constitutional. It's like a zoo out there. Coyotes, bobcats, javelinas. Have you heard of those?
Oh, that sounds horrible. The javelina.
They're very long, thin dog.
No, weird, weird, aggressive pig things.
Yeah.
They attack dogs as well. And because Beanie weighs only a little over 8 pounds, hawks could even pick her up and fly away.
Let's be honest. Beanie's not meant to really go outside where the other big animals are.
Well, that's the thing. Her mom thought, you know what? I feel quite bad because I've brought her out here.
If this was nature, Beanie would have evolved into hoveling into like sand and living under rocks.
Exactly. And I can identify with this woman because I took my dog, in my little Minpin, into McGregor. And he had to fight off cobras and horses and all sorts of
stuff. It's a hard thing for a little dog.
Kind of bad. So she's going to design this vest.
Most of these little dogs would not last very long in the wild. I mean, a lot of them have been bred to the point where they really can't defend themselves. Their teeth and what used to be their claws are completely useless. They're little ornamental things.
Yeah.
A chihuahua. I mean, what's that going to do if it gets into trouble?
So this coyote vest starts at around $100 for spiked Kevlar. They come in a variety of colors, and mm-hmm. they have an LCD blinker.
Yes.
A bite-activated shock device.
Oh.
Whoa.
Bite-activated shock.
So if something bites him,
okay,
it'll shock the shit out of whoever bit him. And then it's also got whiskers, which are these sprays of wire that stand up on the back. Mm-hmm. And obviously it's been designed with...
It'll put off the coyote.
And birds of prey, and wow, even the giant dog down the street whose owners just let him run around.
Huh. It's quite a clever thing. I wonder
if you think about it, the idea is quite modern, but it goes back, the idea of dressing up dogs to ward off attacks is a long lineage. Remember the ancient Greeks? They invented the spiked collar to protect their hunting companions from wolf attacks.
Oh, is that what the spiked collar is for?
Yeah, it's not just to look giffy.
I thought it was to make them look like they were from the East Rand.
Yeah, or into some kinky sex stuff.
Yeah, kinky sex dog.
Yeah. Today you get Anatolian shepherd dogs in Turkey who are equipped with spiked metal collars to protect themselves while they protect livestock. And yeah, it's just that they don't come in a variety of fashionable colors.
I honestly didn't know that the spiked collar was to keep wolves from biting the throat of your dog. I had no idea. Did you know that until today?
No, but I'm going to act like I did because obviously wolves go for throats.
Yeah, I think that's so clever. All right. Very, very helpful.
Yes. Now
what about cats?
Well, the problem is cats don't need protection from much.
Is that a problem?
Things need protection from cats.
Yeah, those hostile things.
So what, like birds?
Yes. This is how to stop your bird murdering cat. I'm sorry. I have the most beautiful birds in my garden, and I watch the weavers build their nests, tear them down, have babies, hatch the eggs. I watch the little mossies or the sparrows bring their babies onto the lawn.
Yeah.
They can't fly. They hop.
Yeah.
And the mom and dad encouraging them, trying to lift them, go, come on, follow me, up into the tree, and down again, and up into the tree. And then I just see one of my cats walking past the window with the baby in its mouth, with the legs hanging up the one end.
Oh, it's a circle of life. It's beautiful.
My one cat in particular likes to go for the moms, the mommy birds.
Oh, that's horrible.
Which is even worse, leaving the dad and baby.
Nasty cat.
To grow stronger as a unit.
I just can't. And mice, the way they fling these things up in the air just for fun. Anyway.
Yeah, cats are vicious, nasty things. They really are.
No, they're apex predators.
Okay. Well, sure. Your domestic cat.
So I don't know about South
Africans.
In
its realm, it's an apex predator.
I don't know about South African stats.
So what kind of an outfit can we put on a cat?
Okay.
To stop it from behaving like this?
Hannibal Lecter mask.
No, Ben, you'd actually be quite surprised to see.
And they'll still look cute in that.
What's been called birds be safe. It makes your cat look like a nincompoop.
You're putting a donut on your cat. That's
Let's
not
be honest.
Fair.
Well, it's like an Elizabethan collar.
Birds have wings, they must just sort their stuff out. Leave
so it's,
the cats
a,
alone.
It's a multicolored collar. It's almost like that cone of shame, but it doesn't go up over the head.
Mm. And that's because birds, obviously, have
very good eyesight.
Very good eyesight, and they're particularly prone to picking up color.
Mm-hmm.
So for years, cats owners have been putting bells on their pets, on their cats, to try and scare away. But the animals actually get used to them. The cats get used to balancing so that the bell doesn't ring.
Wow,
they're that freaking sneaky. Ooh.
They are sneaky.
So now this woman's come up with this. Very unflattering, brightly colored. It's like when those colorful lizards put out their
frills. A fan frill, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, and then it's got just neon colors on it. It's like purples and blues and greens and yellows.
Exactly. So, yeah, and apparently with all the tests that have been done, it's working really well.
It's working really well for the birds and the humans, but the cats are so humiliated.
Yeah. Look, it's not as if they're going hungry. They're getting food. It's just a game to them. So it's not like we're ruining their lives here, you know.
Yeah.
You're just ruining their dignity.
It just means it's like playing with a cat with a little stick of sorts or a ball of wool. You're supposed to let them catch it. Don't make it too difficult for them. Then do that rather.
It's not the same, Leanne. It's just not the same.
Murdering a bird is a very important part of a cat's day.
It's part of their DNA.
Yeah, but I mean, it's actually affecting a lot of the bird population in woodlands in the US, and I'm sure it's having an effect here as well.
Yeah, but if there's no cats, what do you get? A lot of shit in your car. See, there's two sides there.
I'm all for birds be safe colors.
Okay.
Birds be safe.
Birds be safe and cars be shatter.
Your cat murder, your bird murdering cat.
Yeah, that bird shit can go through your paint job.
Corrodes, doesn't
it? That's, yeah.
If you leave it on for a while.
Stuff. So if you see a huge pat of shite from on a car, just go, look there, someone's suppressing a cat.
That should be your first thought.
That should be your first thought.
Okay.
That is ludicrous. All right. Oh, man. Listen, we talked about this at the start of the show this morning. You can listen to the first hour podcast and you'll see what we were on about. But basically, it's that time of year where people go on holiday. Ben was saying these are the most hungover weeks that most people will have all year.
I'm still hungover from Friday.
Overdoing the drinking, office parties, holidays. Eating too much, overindulging basically in everything. What a wonderful time to be alive.
But not what your horoscope said.
No, so what are you going to do? I mean, how do you temper this? Because if you are going to completely overindulge over the next couple of weeks, which most of us will, it doesn't leave you feeling great in January.
No. Well, the millennials seem to be getting it right. All of the millennials except for Sia, who indulged on buckets of vodka and berry juice this weekend.
At least there were fruit in there. Makes me feel healthy.
Yeah, sure.
But there's been a real shift in recent years with a growing sobriety of millennials who've been named Generation Sober.
Yeah.
They're being blamed for dragging down beer sales and even the demise of the pub.
Yes.
What? So what it all is and how they're getting it right is they're drinking mindfully.
What does that mean?
Well, you know, you get like mindful meditation and mindful this and mindful. There's mindful drinking. And it's just about thinking about what you do when you drink. So asking yourself a few questions. Right. Why are you drinking?
Why am I drinking? Because it's there.
So you think of your future self. Decide if you're going to look back on this drink with joy or with regret. If it's joy, have the drink. If it's regret, you need something to short circuit that craving.
I've only regretted the hangover, but the actual drinking experience, I don't think I've had a problem with.
No.
I don't think there's one of them I've regretted.
No, I mean, that's why they're saying it's your future self that might regret it.
Well, maybe my future self isn't too reliable.
And then the things that you see, these tips are usually involved in healthy eating. It's plan some drink-free distractions, so running around the block, having a bath.
But I think there's a huge difference here between people who are drinking because they're miserable and people who are drinking to celebrate. I mean, over the holidays, you're usually drinking to celebrate, right?
That's right, yeah.
Or because your family are there and they make you miserable. That's the truth for some people. Yeah. And some people really don't like their family.
They just need to make it through the day.
Well, exactly. But I mean, so in that case, the one tip that they give is to appreciate every sip. We tend to chug these things down quite a bit. You know, we really do throw it back sometimes. So think about appreciating every sip.
Mm-hmm.
Monitoring your progress. I don't know. Stack up the bottles of wine in front of you. Don't just put them in the bin.
Oh, I don't know if you want to do that.
Yeah, you see.
Might not have space on your coffee table, Leanne.
No. Look, I have two bins in my kitchen. Let's just say that. Embrace the rule of threes is the one.
Which means what?
Tip.
Don't have one, have three.
Yes,
it is. It's saying drink 3 days a week and never more than three drinks each time.
Oh.
No more.
I don't know if that's a good idea. What do we make
of
that?
Because the whole binge drinking thing is what's really negative on, you know.
Yeah, Ben, do you follow the rule of three?
Yes. Well, I do because I can't drink more than three. But then if I'm in the right place, I'll still throw 10 in there. It goes badly, but I mean, you're only middle-aged once.
And 3 days a week. Well, I only drink on 2 days of the week, if at all. Sometimes I won't even do that. So maybe that's also okay, right? I'm just trying to justify
Unless
my own behavior.
Unless it's a bit bingy.
It's bingy. It's totally bingy.
And unfortunately, it's not. I mean, I'm certainly not telling you what to do.
Oh, God, yeah, you're in no position. I don't know why I'm asking you even.
I do the 7-7 rule.
7 drinks, 7 days of the week.
Seven really,
is a divine number, is it not?
Right?
And I really wish there was another day of the week.
Just to fit in more
Just so I could make it 8.
God help us. All right, yes.
But,
do you remember a time where you were sober? I mean, like where you didn't drink at all when you were maybe at high school.
Yeah, do you remember? No. Oh, yes. No, I mean, I only started drinking when I was like 22.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
What kind of?
When I go,
this is why you got to start
when I
early.
Met my husband.
Oh,
so he started you off down the dark path. Huh?
Yeah,
correlated there.
That's where it all happened.
Sure, well, out with bad rubbish. I mean, you're divorced.
Yeah,
but the drink stayed.
It did, but I don't know. I think I try and keep it under control.
Mm.
Whereas before, it was just drowning in my sorrows.
It's,
you know?
It's a personal thing, really. Yeah. Only now, you know what your control
I'm
is.
I'm not putting words into your mouth, but now do you think drinking is woven into your life, as in you can't imagine going a stretch of time without a nightcap every two nights? You know what I mean?
Like, yeah,
a glass
it
of
is,
wine is
it
great.
It is habitual, you know, get home.
You function or you
buy
work
groceries
better.
And you buy wine. You go to Woolies and so you put a bottle of wine into your basket as well.
Yeah.
It does happen like that.
So now you have to do mindful shopping as well?
Right. Yes, probably.
Mindful drinking, mindful shopping, and mind your pets. I've just got a message here from Michelle. She says, my one cat is a professional bird murderer. She goes next door to hide the bodies. I only discovered this when I was looking after the said neighbor's pets last year. Many, many bodies. Michelle.
And how much shit in the cars, Michelle? How much shit in the cars?
Not very much
shit
in the cars.
Exactly. That wasn't much of that part of the message, was it?
Hey guys, my name is Dumisho. I'm a South African currently working in Holland. Thanks to all of you for such a great show. I go away from South Africa for a while and I'm really loving the show. It keeps me clued up about all the necessary things. I still have no idea what Ben looks like, but I really like the sound of his voice and his presentation of sport is the best ever.
Well, thank you very much. I am on social media if you don't look at my face, but it's not the strongest part of me.
Oh.
Pray tell, what is?
I have adapted to Sia. I have adapted to Sia saying and.
And.
Yeah. Working in renewable energy, but I'm doing pre-construction geophysical surveys on the ocean floor. Good Lord.
One more time, pre-construction?
Pre-construction geophysical surveys. So he basically, they put stuff on the ocean floor in the North Sea, just off of Holland.
Whoa.
Isn't that interesting? To Misha, wow. And then Judy says, a question. Oh, no, that's for Anthea, so we'll have to give it to her next week. Here's one from somebody. Are you guys going to talk about what that Popol Andile from BLF said over the weekend? What did he say?
I don't know. I haven't been keeping up.
Yeah, I don't want to pay any attention to that, if you don't mind. I think we'll be happy to not pay attention to that.
All that guy's got is racism and hate, so...
Yes, but a bit of hate, sometimes a bit of racism, sometimes the ratio is a bit different.
It's got something to do with a racial attack on a Joburg lawyer.
Oh, what happened?
So now you do want to know.
Of course I want to know now. You've piqued my interest. Go on. Can you tell me? In brief?
Yeah, I can. So the BLF as a whole, as well as the man of the moment, has admitted that the members did attack a woman racially, but insists they were defending themselves against the lawyer whom they've labeled racist. So apparently this female lawyer was subjected to a vicious racial attack by people wearing black First Land First t-shirts at the High Court in Joburg. The woman was apparently cornered in the foyer of the building just after a protest outside.
I don't understand that. So they physically attacked her even though all she did was use words.
Real tough guys here attacking a woman. Huh. Yeah, again, the caliber of these fucking cretins.
Andile himself says it was an incident of racism and our members did what was required of them as BLF members to defend themselves.
Okay, but you don't defend racism with violence. I don't understand that. How is that going to help? It's not going to change the racism.
Using your body as a physical threat to someone.
Especially first of all, why are you doing this to a woman, you cowards? It seems to me that that's not what strong people do. You don't attack a woman physically.
He says, I endorse their actions and take full responsibility.
Well, then you should go to jail for it, because that's common assault. That's what that is. It's got nothing to do with... And how do you defend racism with violence? That's ridiculous. The whole point of... Like racism, you're fighting an opinion. You're fighting an attitude. You don't fight opinions and attitudes with physical violence. It's not going to change them. What's your purpose here? Do you just want to be cross with someone for saying something you don't like, and that's why you attack them, or do you want to change their mind? Because you can't change someone's mind by beating them up. Usually it makes them go the other way.
What did the lawyer say anyway?
I don't know. I'm trying to look it up.
Because a lot of the time it's quite subjective what's racist when people like who their only agenda is racism. what they deem as racist sometimes isn't even true.
That's also a good point. Yeah, I'd love to know.
Well, if we're speaking about some comments, we haven't actually spoken about Kevin Hart and the entire Oscars thing.
Yeah.
Because a new turn in the events of Kevin Hart being selected as the host of the Oscars in 2019, and then people were bringing up old tweets of his, then he decided to step down. Well, on the hunt for the new host of the Oscars, there are so many Hollywood agents who are now saying, don't even go there. These agents are advising their own talent that the Oscars are just a lose-lose situation. And all of these agents are speaking out about the times that we're living in.
You mean what these to host mean. The Oscars?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, because Kevin Hart, this is an irritating story.
Why can't I remember what Kevin Hart looks like? Which
very,
one is
very
he?
Very short.
He's a
short, funny dude from
Ride Along, Jumanji.
Yeah, Ride Along.
Think Like a Man.
Oh, yes. Okay, I've got him.
And he's a stand-up comedian.
So yeah. Kevin Hart was going to host the Oscars, and people were kind of excited about that. They were like, wow, this is going to be fun because he's a funny guy. And then they dug up some tweets or some comedy material from like a couple of years ago, and some people said it wasn't even that funny. But basically, he was making some homophobic slurs, like saying someone looked gay or something was gay or some faggot word or whatever it was that he used. Now, I mean, we know that that kind of language is probably – and because he's a comedian, it's likely he was joking. It's likely. It's not 100% sure, but it's likely he was joking. He's a funny dude.
Yeah, he wasn't a member of the BLF.
Yeah, and sometimes he's just saying stuff because that's what he's there to do. He's there to make people laugh, and he doesn't hate anybody as far as I could tell. Kevin Hart doesn't seem to be one of those angry, nasty people who wanders around saying shit things.
Well, this is what he's owned up to. In context, some of his tweets were around.
So hang on, just to give everybody the context. So he was going to host the Oscars, yes, but now he's removed himself from it. He's like, I'm not going to do it anymore.
Yeah. These old tweets of his are, some of them are around him saying, I'd never want my son to be gay. It would be the biggest disappointment, blah, 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 blah. And he says he owned up to the fact that that was what he thought then. That is what, and you know, you think of context, you think of times, you think of situations. Growing up in black communities, it's looked down upon. And
well, look,
it's
not even a question. Like, it's much harder to grow up gay than it is to grow up straight,
absolutely,
right? A kid grows up gay, it's really, really hard. They get beaten up, they get bullied, they get treated differently, and especially in the past. Mm-hmm. And so Kevin Hart's coming from a place of actual care. Like, he's saying, I'm reading this as the best possible light, it's much harder to be gay than to be straight. Well, if you're a kid, being gay is very, very difficult.
He said, and he's apologized beforehand. He says he's spoken about that's who he was then. He's now known better. He knows not to say things like that. He knows that it might offend people, and he apologized previously. And so that is why he stepped down to recently last week, because he said, I'm not going to apologize again. I'm not going to have to explain myself again. If I'm detracting and taking away from the event, then so be it. Rather have someone else in my place. But what I find now interesting is all of these agents who are banning all of their own talent. One of them saying that we don't encourage our clients to host the Oscars anymore because every host just gets picked apart by vultures. And another says the jobs become a lose-lose for everyone, and Hollywood's finally figured it out. Big stars have lots to lose. And he says new ones just don't get ratings. And I think that says a lot about the what sort of culture we're living in
Now.
Well,
what is the Oscars but really a bunch of really elitist, really coddled, really up their own asses actors and actresses who are looking for more public adulation than they already get.
What's going to be funny now?
And standing up and virtue signaling what good people they are. And do you remember the Oscars with the Me Too thing and all those women wearing black and
the Emmys?
Do me a favor. Who needs to watch that shit?
So I think they're in a pickle for next year.
Do you really need to watch? I haven't watched the Oscars for years. Who watches it?
No.
I've watched the highlights. I didn't watch the whole thing.
Well, I just, as a person who's always been a fan, have even been put off over the past couple of years because it does become...
It's like political.
Or like, no, Meryl, we just want to see you,
Meryl,
gain weight, you have an accent.
You pretend
star,
for a
you
living.
Call it a day.
You pretend, and it's also become this big anti-Trump congregation.
That's
all these Hollywood like people Bob get together. All the ones who haven't been fingered by a Weinstein get together and they all stand there and talk about how shitty Trump is. And what an awful man he is, and how they're so much better than him, and they know better than him, and the people in America are stupid because they voted for Trump.
Mm.
It's just, who wants to hear from these people?
And they're losing enough. Out. They're right. losing on ratings, they're losing on revenue. So.
It's over. Get out of here.
Get out of here.
All right, today at 8 a.m., we bring you another episode in our series, For the Love of Law, where we take you behind the desks of some of South Africa's smartest lawyers. Hiring and firing in South Africa is not easy. Now, if you're not sure how to do it, especially since the law keeps on changing, at least Lisa Ann King knows what's going on. Yeah, she is well known for her role at Flaxman's as a director in the Labor Law Department. Since 2004, she's been the head of human resources, both for clients and for the firm. You can find out all about her and hear our discussion with her at cliffcentral.com. For the Love of the Law is brought to you by Flaxman's Attorneys, one of South Africa's leading law firms. You can go and meet Lisa Ann King. She's cool. She's very, very sharp. Knows her labor law. And let me tell you, in this country, the labor law, it's not just a whole separate area of the law. It's a whole separate area of the economy. Hiring and firing people is impossible. And if you don't have a good lawyer on your side, you are in big trouble.
Ooh.
That law keeps changing. They need to know the Employment Act. They need to know the Labor Relations Act. I mean,
Minimum Wage Act.
Minimum Wage Act. Are you kidding me? This Lisa Ann King's a genius. You need to go and hear what she has to say about all of this. All right. It is 7:30. We're going to bring in Connor?
Mm-hmm.
All right. I want to tell you about this guy. So I've met him a couple of times before. Last time he was in South Africa, I saw him. But Connor McCready has achieved a level of success in the international art world that most artists really only dream of. He's attracted the interest of curators, gallery owners, collectors, established artists all around the world. What goes into this world-renowned work, and how does it make all of this occur? Because it's a hard world to break into, the art world. And we have him in studio with us this morning to find out a whole lot more. So first of all, welcome, dude. Nice to see you. Are you good? Yeah, we'll put the headphones on. How are you?
Great. How are you doing?
Good
to see you.
Yeah,
it's nice to see
you.
I haven't seen you in 3 years, I think.
You've done so well. My God. Not that you were doing badly before, but you're doing really, really well. How's it going? How's the business of art?
It's very good. It's a busy time right now because it's Art Basel Miami, which is just about to finish. So I've got two of my paintings on display there now.
Yeah?
I couldn't make it.
Where are you? You're based in Zurich now.
Yeah, Zurich. Yeah.
Wow. Okay, what's that? First of all, why Switzerland? Because you were in America for a long time.
Yeah, that's right. New York.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Very different, Zurich. A bit more calmer. Same time zone as South Africa.
Right.
Still have family and friends in South Africa. So.
All right, but you were born here. You grew up here. You went to school here, and then you went on like a golf scholarship to North Carolina, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that was.
Were you going to become a professional golfer?
I did. I wanted to. Yeah, I loved golf. I really did. A friend of mine, actually, I think he's number 49 or 41 in the world now, Dylan Fratelli.
Yeah.
We used to play a lot together.
Wow.
So it's just crazy to see these guys how well they are doing.
The last 2 years, he's made money, like big money.
Dylan, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's doing well. We actually spoke the other day on our WhatsApp about he wanted a pair of our sneakers that we've just done a collaboration with Ludwig Reiter. And he's actually getting into trying to design his own style with Nike for the next Masters. So that's quite cool. Sneakers are quite popular right now, aren't they?
Sneakers are huge. Now, this is actually the thing that I saw and that you tipped me off on. This is like the world's most expensive pair of sneakers.
I think so.
Is that what they are?
I don't want to say I am coining that they're the world's most expensive, but I was told they are the world's most expensive. So I said to somebody, could you find out what are the previous prices of some of these expensive handmade sneakers? And yeah, they said our sneakers are pretty much the most expensive pair of sneakers they've ever heard.
How much are these? First of all, are there a limited number of them?
Yeah, there's only 200 in the world, yeah.
200?
200, yeah.
So only 200 people ever have these sneakers?
That's true.
So that's pretty impressive because that's like owning a work of art. You shouldn't even wear them.
That's exactly. A lot of people ask, what do we do? What do we do with them?
Mm-hmm.
Do we wear them? Yeah, sure, yeah. For special functions. A lot of private bankers, or not a lot, six of them have bought. They wear them in their boardroom meetings. They think it's cool with their suits. I mean,
right.
It looks quite cool.
Sure.
Some art collectors, really important collectors, they just keep them in boxes in their collections.
Well, I would imagine that whatever you buy them for now, let's say that they're, $100,000 or something. I would imagine that if you keep them in the box, then in a couple of years' time, they'll be worth even more.
Definitely not $100,000. But
how much are we talking?
I think they are 3,333 francs, which is 3,000 euros.
Okay.
So what's the exchange rate in rand? Was it about 56,000 rand for a pair of sneakers? I think it's really expensive. I don't even have a pair.
What do they look like?
They're quite cool. Actually, they're hand painted. They've got the pigment on them. They're hand stamped, and it's quite a meticulous process.
Is that sort of your signature color?
Yeah, it's my own color. It's called McCready Blue. Yeah.
Yeah, so you actually developed that. What was the inspiration for that
color? Yeah, we trademarked it in 2011.
Uh-huh.
A lot of people always ask me, why blue, Connor? Why blue? I mean, I've been asked this question probably 100,000 times, and it's my favorite color. It's that simple.
It's a beautiful color. It's almost like an electric blue.
Yeah,
huh?
Yeah.
No, it's very bright. It's gorgeous. So here are the sneakers, Leanne. They sort of look like white canvas. You know, it's almost like tennis shoes.
It's Nappa calf leather. So the finest leather you can get in the world.
And there it is. And then it's got this blue, almost like smudges on it, right?
Yeah, it's a paint. I stroke it with my paintbrushes.
Strokes it with his paintbrushes.
Really cute, Ben. Yeah.
They're amazing. They're very, very pretty.
Thank you.
Yeah, gorgeous.
I think the company's really cool. When we had a meeting, I was really honored to partner and do a collaboration with these guys. I mean, they're established in 1885. So what do the numbers? What is that? 133 years old.
Yeah. Who is Ludwig Reiter?
It's one of the oldest Austrian shoe families, still family-run business, based in Vienna. They've got a beautiful castle estate where all the shoes are made in this Schloss, as you say in German, castle. And that's where they make them. So it's beautiful. It really is. It's a special setup there.
What interests me is that you've done so many different things. You've worked on so many varied projects over the years. You can't really say it's just art in one medium. You know, we used to think of artists as being either a painter or a sculptor or a graphic designer or a performance artist. But it seems to me that like over the years, you've done a whole lot of these things and you just keep on adding to your compendium of talents. So, I mean, how would you describe it if someone didn't know you?
Well, I think it's difficult to, you know, you can't do too many collaborations. You know, you can't, if you're an artist and you're building yourself as an artist, you can't build a luxury brand per se on its own. So the most important thing to do is to rather collaborate with very well-established brands in that field to create limited edition works of art because if you start to do unlimited, it kind of devalues the actual original paintings. So there's got to be a structure to it. I mean, a very, very interesting friend of mine, big collector, owns about 12 of my paintings. It's just built this magnificent lodge in the Sabi Sands.
Oh.
And he'd commissioned me to paint this Mapocho lion painting of the lion clan out there. And it's funny because he actually bought edition number one of the sneakers. Which is so cool. And I don't think he wants to wear them. He wants to put them on display in the lodge.
Yeah.
So it's like a few facets of the art. It's, you know, we've done the trunks with Timo. Yours are waiting there. I'm not going to make you wear. I thought you were going to wear them in the interview.
I could put them on. So it
looked quite cool with the yellow cliff color, Cliff Central, cadmium yellow in the background, and then his McCready blue trunks.
There we go.
You know.
So listen, what interests me is that you've been described in various ways. First of all, let me give a little bit of credit here. You sold a record number of paintings for any single artist at the Kunst 14 Zurich Art Fair.
Well, I didn't sell them. The art dealer.
The art dealer did. But, I mean, you painted these.
Yes.
You've sold out solo exhibitions around the world from New York to Johannesburg, Hong Kong, and Zurich. Mm-hmm. In 2014, Bloomberg Markets TV described you as the next luxury brand. And that's already happened, obviously, since 2014. I mean, those are kind of nice things people to say about you. Any artist would be thrilled with that.
I mean, there's a lot of negative things as well. I mean, that's part of being an artist, right?
Sure.
I mean,
but have you received negative attention in what respect? Because there's people don't like your work?
Oh, yeah. I mean, a lot of people, they either love it or they hate it. I mean, a lot of people think, oh, my child can paint a splash like this, which is great. I mean, it's taken me 31 years to create that splash, theoretically.
Sure.
And those type of people don't know enough background about the history of my art or what I began painting. I began painting fine South African landscapes when I was 12 years old. So it's been a journey.
Yeah.
And it evolves over time.
So Connor, are doing your day-to-day stuff? I mean, you spend a lot of time traveling. You obviously spend a lot of time in the business of art. But how much time do you get to dedicate to painting itself?
Well, there's never enough, but it's up to us as artists to find the time. I mean, now I'm preparing for the Moscow solo show. I'm going to Okavango Delta to visit my brother.
Nice. What does he do there?
Wednesday. He's the general manager of Mombo, which is a luxury camp which is run by Wilderness Safari Group.
Oh, yes.
And he is the general manager, and the actual lodge has been named now the world's most luxurious safari lodge. So credit to my brother. I'm really excited to see him. And that's I get a lot of inspiration out there with the palm trees. You know, I'm doing a whole palm tree series now.
Yeah.
And then
so while you're there, you got Moscow. Your paints with you. Will you manage to get any painting done, or are you taking
these? I've actually asked him just to get a notepad and some pastels for me out there, but I really just want to sit and relax and take in the inspiration. You know, no phones, 3 days of no phones. It's amazing. I can't wait. And then straight after that, I'm flying straight to Moscow from Botswana, which is
that's a big change.
Yeah. And it's going to be about minus 16 degrees there. So the show begins on the 18th of December. Exhibition.
Are you quite disciplined about how much time you get to spend painting? I mean, you didn't really answer my question. Are you able to say? Are you able to say, look, I'm going to do 3 hours of this today, and then something comes up and you have to leave it? I mean, this is the point, right? Most people, we think of art as being an optional extra, a luxury. Mm. We think of it as being something that people will do.
Interesting, you see it as a luxury as well. I mean, it is a part of a luxury class.
Art, yes, of course it is.
But as an artist, also being, I think, semi-ADD myself, it's difficult to say, okay, this is the time I have to paint. I mean, it's just the inspiration comes and it's there.
So sometimes you will have no intention of painting, and then you'll sit down and next thing is 3 a.m.
Sometimes that's true. Look, for commissions like my friend's lodge, Cheetah Plains in the Sabi Sands, it's an absolutely magnificent lodge. He commissioned to do, how many was it? 5 big paintings. And, you know, the lion painting was painted with olive oil from Samos, the islands of Greece. In the oil paint mixed with my pigment. And I couldn't just, you know, paint when I want. I had to get this finished in time for the lodge to launch. So
sometimes
there's
a lot
of pressure sometimes if it's commissions.
And if you've got a big gallery showing, you have to get all your stuff.
Yeah, like Moscow now. That was, we had to do quite a lot of splash paintings for the show. The splash paintings are my favorite because I can sort of really lose myself and go wild in these canvases, not so confined and controlled, which I love. So, it's important to try and allocate as much time as possible. In the end, that's my true craft. That is what I have to focus on mainly. So,
but it is quite something. I mean, it's first of all testament to the fact that you really are well received and that you've done an incredible thing carving yourself out this niche in the art world, because it's a hard place to make it. And a lot of artists have to do other things to supplement their income. And if you can live off of your art and you can be a full-time creative, that's quite an incredible place to be.
I think so, yeah. I think if you can make a living primarily as an artist, that's a luxury.
You know,
you've got to really be working quite hard at your craft to be able to do that, you know.
What's going on there?
I think it's your fly. Your fruit flies in your studio.
Jesus, have we got fruit flies in here? Someone
they
get
like
the
smell of the pigment on my fingers.
Yeah. All right, I think it's very, very cool. How often do you get to come back to South Africa?
Not as often as I'd like. I was here, I think you knew, a week ago, but then I had to fly back to Zurich because I had to paint another 35 more shoes.
So each one's hand.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually a lot of work. You know, people don't realize it's a lot of work. These get made in Vienna. They get delivered to the HQ in Zurich. Then I've got to sit. I've got to hand number them with my assistant with the Excel codes, and then the factory's got to confirm that these certificates are correlating to these exact numbers of the shoes. And it's actually a lot of fun too. I really enjoy it. It's a different medium for me, painting on leather. It's nice. The pigment sticks really well.
What do you have to use as the medium there? I mean, what kind of paints do you use?
So it's my pigment. It's water-based. And it gets mixed with a type of acrylic bondage. So it's actually, I shouldn't really say this because the factories say these are artworks, you can't return them, the shoes, you know, but the pigment's actually waterproof. It's waterproof, it's snowproof, it's sunproof.
I was going to say, because
you paint it on a jet or
a plane.
It'd
be such a shame if you bought these really expensive sneakers and then
someone
couldn't wash them.
Well, no, you don't actually, you're not really supposed to wash them. You shouldn't wash them.
they'll be clean.
It's a work of art. No, you shouldn't wear them every day. Occasion. You should. I mean, if you're going on the Cliff Central show, then you should wear them. But you should, you're not supposed to wash them. You don't really wash paintings, right? I mean, you restore paintings. So maybe if you keep your shoes. There you go.
So listen, you were commissioned to paint the Time Warner logo.
Yeah, that's a long time ago. Jeez.
Yeah, I mean, but this is quite a big deal. This is when you were in New York.
Well, it was actually my first big
commission.
Commission, I guess you said like that. Yeah, commission. Time Warner. That was a long time
ago. Was it in the Time Warner building? There on Columbus Circle?
Yeah, those two tall, they look like mini twin towers. It's a beautiful building.
And
the paintings are still in there.
I'm sure. Yeah. What do you think? They put them into storage?
No, they're on the walls. They're on the storage. They're on the walls. I haven't been there, though.
Do you keep any of your work? Is there any of it that you're so attached to that you don't want to give
away? I kept two skull paintings. I like the skulls. I hate skulls. But when I was in Tulum, Mexico, I was inspired by this way they love the energy of rebirth and skeletons.
Right. They often paint skulls because they have that Day of the Dead.
Sure, sure.
Which is a celebration that they have in Mexico. So exactly. You decided at that
point. It inspired me to go and paint skulls. And I kept two little ones. I really love them. And the guy in Parma, my art dealer. Jeez, let me just be clear here. I'm on live TV. If you swear on the show.
You're allowed
to
swear.
You don't get beeped out.
No.
Right?
This is totally.
But I haven't sworn once, right?
You haven't. You've actually
it's
been
really
very good.
Good for me.
I know.
But the...
You're
sorry, what were we saying?
You're saying the dealer?
Yeah, the art dealer in Parma wanted to sell the small skull. He had a very interesting German collector, but I didn't want to sell it. I just love it. And then I got into trouble, apparently. I mean, he was swearing at me on the phone. I lost my fucking mind. What's wrong with me? I've only got two left, and I don't want to sell them.
No, keep them.
And I'm not going to.
That's pretty awesome. All right, Connor. Well, it's very nice to see you, man. And congratulations on your success so far. I hope that we continue to hear good things about you and do come back and visit every now and then.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on the show. It's been great.
Keep changing the world, man.
Thanks. I'm trying.
Sounds like that's what you're doing.
Thank you so much.
Connor McCready will put up all the info if you want to follow him on social media. You can get him on Twitter and Instagram, and you could see some of his work on Instagram too. It's very, very interesting stuff. Rich Mulholland coming up next. All right. A little Rita Ora and Liam Payne for you. It is time for us to check in on Rich Mulholland, only because we're worried about his mental health. We do this every week. Actually, it's not for us, it's for him. People don't know that. They think that it's an opportunity for us to hear some of the wisdom from Rich, but actually, we're just making sure he's not doing anything dangerous. Rich Mulholland, how are you, sir?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
Good, good, good. Did you hear any of that, by the way?
I just got the very last sentence.
Okay, good. Good.
Crap. What did you say?
Now you'll have to go and listen to the intro on the podcast.
Oh, dear me. Okay.
No, all right, go on. What do you got for us today?
So, I'm going to read poetry to you today, which is the thing.
All right.
Yeah, I don't think we do that enough. So, I go to this conference a few weeks ago, and it's called an unconference. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that conferences are terrible. Therefore, let's create a conference that doesn't act like a conference at all.
Okay.
And I don't want to sound unappreciative because this is one of these all expenses paid things and you arrive there and it's nice. And it was lovely seeing lots of cool people. However, the conference was terrible.
Oh, really?
And the reason the conference was terrible is because it was an unconference. Because their whole argument was that, well, conferences are dull and boring. Therefore, why don't we try change this up a little bit and let anybody arrive at any time and write their name on a whiteboard, and then they can talk about something and you can choose to go and see this. And instead of bringing in these experts from outside, what we have is people, can just stand up and share anything they're passionate about. Turns out this is not a recipe for good, right? And here's the thing that I want to get across is that conferences aren't bad. Bad conferences are bad. There are amazing conferences, and actually the hallmark of the good ones are not that people prepare less, it's that they prepare more.
Yes.
And it is not that they're curated less, it's that they're curated more. And so what's happened is we're getting into this idea of throwing the baby out with the bathwater, where we're creating work, we're saying that we don't like thing A, and instead of fixing it, we're just trying to completely reinvent it, and I think that's problematic.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's like so much in society these days. People are, instead of finding ways to improve on a model that they're not entirely satisfied with, they throw out the baby with the bathwater and decide that everything is crap and the whole thing must be demolished. And that usually leads to a whole lot more unhappiness, not less.
Yeah, it's actually, and I mean, it's going to sound like I'm blowing smoke up your eyes, but except that it's the truth. It's why I like what you did with Cliff Central. You see, everybody else said radio is dead. Let's listen to podcasts or things like this. And their argument was the one medium is not good. Therefore, we should do something else completely different. Whereas what you said is the one medium is not good enough. Let's make it better and fix it. And I think that has to be the approach. Why are we throwing out this entire format? There's something beautiful and amazing about it, and I understand that there will be an evolution over time. Mm-hmm. But it's about making, if you don't like something about something, make the best version of that.
Yeah. Yeah, improve, yeah. Don't destroy.
Yeah, you know, in presentations, and I actually remember ranting about this once, maybe years ago, quite near the beginning, and I spoke about, people talk about death by PowerPoint. You know, and as I always say, blaming PowerPoint for a bad presentation is like blaming a pan for the bad meal. Like, it's not the tool's fault. Just mm-hmm. be better at how you use it. Anyway, so, I'm reminded. So when I was young, my mom and dad went to a John Denver show when he was in the UK. And years later, they released a video of this show, and my parents had it, and we all watched it. And in it, he recited a poem, which was quite bizarre. And it's a poem that I've never forgotten. It's fairly long, so I picked like 3 or 4 verses. I just wanted to read to you guys now.
Cool.
But I think it's really cool, and I think it's one of these things that stuck with me for, I don't know, 35-odd years, that I figure it's worth hearing just to remember. So here we go. It says, I'll tell you the name of it afterwards. Mm-hmm. 'Twas a dangerous cliff, as they freely confessed, though to walk near its edge was quite pleasant. But over the side it slipped a duke and a prince, and it fooled many a peasant. The people all said something had to be done, but their projects did not at all tally. Some said, put a fence around the edge of the cliff. Others, an ambulance down in the valley. A collection was made to accumulate aid, and dwellers in highways and alleys gave pounds and pence, not to furnish a fence, but an ambulance down in the valley. Said one in his plea, it's a marvel to me that you'd give so much greater attention to repairing the results than to curing the cause, when we'd much rather aim at prevention. He's wrong in the head, the majority said. He would end all our earnest endeavors. He's the kind of jerk that would end our good work, but we will support it forever. Don't we pick them all up just as quick as they fall and treat them with care liberally? Why, a superfluous fence is of no consequence when an ambulance runs in the valley. That's the name of the poem, by the way. The name of the poem is The Ambulance Down in the Valley.
Beautiful.
And I think this so perfectly captures what people try to do. They try to constantly run these ambulances down in the valley instead of building fences at the top of cliffs. And I think Cliff Central, and I just got that. I can't believe. Shit. I should have worked on that better beforehand. That would have been beautiful. Anyway, I think that that's what we have to do, is that we have to try and build better fences. And if you look at something that's broken, don't immediately attack and come up with alternatives. Sometimes it's cool to look at it and say, I wonder if there's a better way we can do this. And actually improve on things rather than just fix them after they break. And I think that this is what this conference should have done. Instead of going out there and throwing out all the format that they felt could have broken something, they should have rather just looked and found good, smart people willing to share information in a smart way. And I think they would have had a captivated audience, like the amazing ones like TED and PopTech do.
Yeah.
So that's my thought.
I love it.
Build better fences.
I love it. It reminds me also of the fact that we're living in a time now where people are trying to reevaluate some of the stuff we've been doing as humans for centuries. And they're saying, well, there might be a better way. And sometimes we do find a much better way of doing things, but sometimes we also throw out some stuff that's pretty damn good and time tested and has evolved, and changed slowly and gently over generations, that still has enormous value. So we've got to be careful not to throw out everything.
Yeah, I think we're impatient. We think that we can change everything quickly, but a lot of changes through the ages have occurred so slowly.
Yeah, like a glacier.
Yes.
Yes. All right.
For sure. And I think that we should be looking to constantly improve, right? There's no doubt of that.
Sure.
I just don't think, as soon as we find something that we think is not perfect, Therefore, and funny enough, this goes to a lot of popular opinion of people nowadays. If everything, like the Kevin Hart thing you guys discussed earlier, you know, if you say one thing bad, therefore you must be the enemy. And I know that's kind of a leap, but it's that mindset that I think is broken.
I couldn't agree more. What a lovely thought. And thank you for that poem. It's brilliant.
Thanks, guys.
Very nice. Thank you, Rich. Rich Mulholland, everybody. Reality check on a Monday. Always the best way to start your week. I hope you're ready for a good week. We have the Fluxman's Attorney series for the Love of Law coming up next. And one of the very interesting partners there is someone called Lisa Ann King. She is the person to talk to when it comes to HR and to labor law. And she's definitely someone you'll want to hear from this morning. So if you have an interest, then that is probably something for you. All right, time for the unnews. Let's get to it. Are you ready? Are you sitting comfortably?
Let's take. Okay.
Okay, are you? Right, let's go then. All right, so, An East London woman is suing the DA for 10 million rand for interviewing her in a toilet. Yes, this actually happened. In their defense, the DA said the toilet had a door, so this incident is to be treated separately from other previous toilet cases, all right? This weekend saw a drop in load shedding by Eskom. This is mostly because Eskom had a huge Christmas party on Friday, so the staff normally in charge of shutting the power were too hungover to show up, and things just ran as they should. And finally, the Blitzbox came up short again in the Cape Town Sevens, finishing with a bronze medal. Though a big disappointment for the players, the fans were so drunk they didn't even notice. We will see you tomorrow between 6 and 9.
This is CliffCentral.com.